Welcome to Flowcast. I'm Sister Beth Murphy. My guests today are Amber Harris and Michael Carlson, who are here to talk about restorative justice. What it is, first of all, and how we can apply the principles of restorative justice to help transform our world. May we start with introductions. Amber and I are both members of SDART, the Springfield Dominican Anti-Racism Team. Michael is a former SDART member who came into the Springfield Dominican orbit in 2017 when he began teaching theology at Sacred Heart Griffin High School, our sponsored school in Springfield. As he began looking around for tools the high school could use to address concerns regarding student discipline, he met Amber, who is the co-founder of the Restorative Justice Movement Center, a community organization in St. Louis that aims to restore right relationship, repair the damage caused by trauma, and rebuild the community using inclusive, trauma-informed, nonviolent methods. Michael is now principal of St. Patrick's School in Springfield, but his partnership with Amber has been a gift that continues to inform Sacred Heart Griffin and SDART as we move toward the goal of repairing harm, rebuilding relationships, and reconciling stakeholders in situations of inequity or injustice. Would you like to say anything further about what you are doing these days? Perhaps, Amber, you could bring me up to speed.
Our latest endeavor is partnering with Department of Justice, Juvenile Justice, as we begin to enter into that facility and educate faculty on the methods of restorative justice there, and the approach and the delivery of the circles and the methodology of restorative justice.
That sounds very interesting, Amber. Maybe we can get into that as we go through the podcast. Thank you for sharing that. Michael, what's happening with you?
I am principal of St. Patrick Catholic Elementary School in Springfield, and our mission is to be an affordable school of choice with high academic and character standards. I have started with some really basic restorative justice practices and we are really looking forward to moving forward and continuing these practices throughout the school.
Well, that also sounds intriguing, so I'm anxious to hear more. Let's start, Amber, by defining what restorative justice is. Would you do that for us?
In short, restorative justice is a way to address those who have harmed and those who are doing the harm in a collective community way to address the outcome of the behavior, to change the outcome for the community.
That makes great sense to me. So, for instance, if you've got two students in a school, one of whom has said something hurtful to another, one response would be to give the child who harmed that other student a detention or some other kind of punishment. And that might separate those two, but it's not going to repair the relationship between them. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying. It's definitely relationship work and relationship building, seen through the lens that that's what we want to happen. Society has said that we give punishment and that's the only consequence, as if that's the accountability for the action that is done, but it does nothing to repair the relationship after the act is done. And so we believe that if we begin to repair the individual, we'll repair the family, we'll repair the community and society as a whole. So we look at building the relationship. Every lens we look at and every incident that we look at is through the lens of relationship work. Where is this going to take the relationship, even on the criminal aspect, for something as heinous as a rape or a murder? We're always looking at how can we begin to repair and rebuild the relationship? If it's not between the two individuals, it's definitely within the mind of the individual.
So you are using restorative justice principles everywhere from elementary schools all the way through the penal system.
Yes, ma'am.
Would you tell me something about how you became such a strong practitioner and advocate for restorative justice models?
Yeah, very quite simply, it is my life. I though I am a daughter of a military veteran, a Desert Storm veteran, and I have two older brothers who are also military retired, I chose another life. I used drugs for 20 years. And though I attended HBCUs, the Catholic schools, I made some choices. And throughout that time, I understand now that that time has taught me the understanding, the empathy from both sides. And so I now presently have 16 years clean. My work and my advocacy came from my my profession is a healthcare worker. I work with those who are in palliative care, hospice, geriatric mental health, and wound care. That is my expertise. That is my medical profession for the last 16 years. But I, for the last 9 years, I've come to restorative justice because the very neighborhoods that I used in, I now apply this method in, and the success of us doing what we thought we needed. My husband and I is also in recovery. He's got 26 years, and he is now a substance abuse co-occurring counselor, and he works in the field of social justice. What we started to apply to the community were the things that we found were lacking. He goes into the penitentiaries and he speaks to the gentleman getting ready to come out, and he began to notice the gap and why recidivism was so prominent in certain areas, because there was issues of trauma, and it bloomed and stemmed from the needs that kept people clean from addiction, from active addiction, and into recovery, because we believe in the recovery 12-step model of attending meetings and supporting your recovery with support help groups. And we also understood that once we started addressing the trauma, they were less likely to repeat the act of the crime that was once committed.
Thank you so much. So what you're saying is you see that when the trauma is healed, acts that cause injustice to others more easily melt away, and the community is healed and restored.
And the community is healed and restored, and the example of that act through the process of healing, addressing the trauma, addressing the issues that created an act that has nothing, the feelings that have nothing to do with the act that was displayed. Once we were able to identify, name, and address those issues, those witnesses, this is why we believe in community so much, those witnesses began to heal as well. Because when you remove an individual, there is a grief that happens. There is an absence that happens based on removing them from the unit, the family unit or community at that time. And so once we began to repair and rebuild the individual back, the community healed as well.
That is such a hopeful truth to hear from you. And congratulations to you and your husband for the work that you're doing. So at some point, and I'm not sure that I know the whole story, but Michael had an encounter with you that led him to think that restorative justice would have something to offer in an educational setting. So Michael, would you talk to us about that a little bit?
The search for Amber took about 60 seconds. I Googled restorative justice, St. Louis, and then I called and the reason for that call was because there was not a discipline system that involved restoration. And that's pretty normal and it's pretty typical. And it's also something that's really been inculcated at this point in our education history as a country for generations. And there was a real need, which I first saw for community teaching in theology classes, because I saw what's pretty normal in a lot of American Christianity, which includes American Catholicism, a very individual approach to faith. And it was my salvation, and I care for my family, and well, that's a wrap. It's a lot easier to just talk about relationships and how we all need community. Because it's, you know, it's pretty well documented. You know, there are just fewer community organizations in the United States now than, you know, there were, you know, in the 70s. There's, you know, increased isolation with a lot of people. You know, and frankly, it doesn't really work out too well for our own individual happiness when you don't have a lot of opportunities for community. And, you know, so Amber, outside of the specific Catholic context, is taking on a lot of cultural norms that I can address directly with the very heart of Christianity, with the Trinity and Jesus loving creation so much that Jesus came to be present and build community. So, you know, it's important to remember the cross part of the sign of the cross, but the Trinity and the cross are, you know, this is a natural continuation of an entire life of ministry. So for our purposes at St. Pat's, it's always going to fit in with our faith. And it's also something that makes faith real. I mean, we have religion classes, but that really only means anything if you can put it into application. So asking students, you know, at the end of restorative justice circle, when there is an issue in the classroom with students or with teachers, and when we end with a prayer for each other, that's when it really can come together for students, because it's just really hard to pray for someone you don't like. I mean, I think you can either dislike someone or you can pray for them, and you really can't do both. And that was some of the best advice from teaching I got from Sister Ave Armstrong in West Catholic in Philadelphia. And that was when I asked, you know, what's your advice for teaching? That was the first thing she said, was pray for your students every day by name. And whenever I have not done that, I've really regretted it. And it really is something that I really recommend every teacher do. And they do, because the restoration through praying for someone is very cathartic, and it just really feels good, because I really think that's the way that God wired us. I really do think that's an important part of our ontology. Ultimately, we are called to community the same way God intrinsically models this for us by existing as a Trinity.
And that's what you're modeling for the students at St. Patrick's. Do you have any examples, Michael? Do you have any stories you can tell us from, without giving away confidences, of course?
Sure.
How this has worked for you at St. Patrick's? You were just beginning to get the program into place at Sacred Heart Griffin when you were hired away and went to St. Pat's. So really, I'm interested in hearing from you what's been happening at St. Pat's since you've been there.
So really, two specific practices, but the language has to come first. And I'm, you know, I think this is a big part of how we think as humans. Sometimes it's helpful to get the language first, and then our minds can work around that. It gives us some order out of the chaos of meaning when we start with the language of community. So this year, our motto as a school is build community. We teach in a school, not in a classroom. And everyone in the building is an educator. Every single person is an educator. We educate in different ways, but it's always by our modeling. It's always by how we treat not just students, but also each other in the hallways, in emails. And another part that can be helpful to talk about in a faith context at a Catholic school is it's also how we treat ourselves. And we are a community within ourselves as, you know, hylomorphic beings. We're a body and a soul, and those things are both very important.
And hylomorphic beings? You might need to explain what that means.
We're in souled bodies. So there's, you know, sometimes I think, example of binary Christianity is privileging the soul and thinking that the body is, you know, basically trash. Doesn't matter. Who cares? You know, and so this is not uncommon, you know, today, even with Christians and saying, well, it doesn't matter what happens after my body, after I'm dead, it doesn't matter. And it's an important thing for you to honor because of what it did during your life. And the idea of physical health is as important as metaphysical health, because your body and your soul are in a relationship with each other. They're a community, and your physical health is very important. It's really hard to love someone when you're depressed, when you're angry. It's pretty tough. So one practice with student discipline. So starting with that language about community, we build on by changing individual student discipline issues in the classroom. And so the criterion of sending a student out of the classroom is if they're unable to learn in community. And so in the classroom, teachers teach that if you get upset, what do you need to do? And there's a calm corner, and they're not in trouble if they go to the calm corner. They go there until they can be calm. And so, you know, it's part of recognizing, wow, I'm really heated up. They don't hide anything on their face, and they huff and puff, and they'll go on their own. And it's about getting what you need so you can get back to the community. But I mean, they're kids, they're executive functioning. I mean, for some of them, like, basically doesn't exist. You know, school's a time to learn how to be in community. So for the teacher's criterion is if the student is unable to learn in community, not if the kid's being bad, it's all right. One reason or another, it could be, you know, sadness, you know, kids cry because that morning they didn't, you know, get the breakfast they wanted, you know, that might come back at 10:10. But that still means if they're crying, they still are not able to learn in community. They might be upset at, you know, that someone else might, you know, they might get upset at something else in the classroom, but that's a criterion. And so basically the method we started to success is the student will be sent to me. I have a 10-minute timer, and by the time 10 minutes are over, no one was upset after that. And so it would almost be comical how jolly they would be, because after 10 minutes, they'd stop being angry, and then they would, you know, they'd be in the principal's office, which is a, you know, endless source of novelty to kids. And it would be a great opportunity for us to talk and go through the steps of, you know, things like, all right, tell me what happened. And we get to a point of, all right, what do we need to do to repair the relationship? And I ask the question, all right, are you ready to build community? And I've had some of the older students say no, that they weren't ready yet, because they know what build community means. It means it's going to take some effort. It's worth setting the timer another 10 minutes and letting them really think about this. When they say, yes, I'm ready to build community, they know what that means. I walk them to the classroom. I switch with the teacher so that the two of them can have some privacy. It gives the teacher, it just takes away any potential for shame, and it evens the power dynamic, because a classroom teacher, they need to be the one in charge. They need to be the one trusted. And it's a different context when you're trying to repair that relationship one-to-one. So I take over in the class. I guarantee you they don't learn anything when I'm the teacher for 60 seconds. I do what I can, but the teacher is in the hallway with the student, and they have the time and the patience and the space to, you know, crouch down eye to eye, take turns listening, and then get to the point where they can say a quick prayer for each other. And it's a really a secret weapon, for lack of a better term, when teachers say, all right, I'll be praying for you. And kids of all ages can almost be shocked by that. And it's something that kids really deserve to have said to them. But it makes sense, because you can be a little scared of a teacher. And when they say they're praying for you, you know, it really can disrupt the narrative of the teacher doesn't like me for, you know, this thing that I did, or, you know, they're picking on me and they should be, you know, someone else should have been in trouble. And when a teacher says, thank you so much, all right, I'll be praying for you, would you join me in a quick prayer? No child has ever or will say nope. If you ask to pray with them, they'll never say no. It can be really disarming, and it does build the emotional connection that you really need to trust someone to learn from them and to see your students as not just things for you, not just products for you to raise their test scores, see the results. When you really see them as more than the grades, it is always through relationship building one way or another. So seeing this in the classroom with that specific measure has been effective, I think. Parents like it, and it's also something that it's at the end of the day, or right then, depending on what the circumstance is, it's a lot more explicable for parents in knowing what happened for me to explain the process and then to say, and then the teacher and your student talked about this, he's totally restored to the community, they prayed together, and we move forward the rest of the day. Instead of saying, you know, your son got in trouble today, boy, was he in trouble. You know, it's no one wants to hear that. And it's also not that helpful.
Right. Who wouldn't rather hear that your kid had a great day at school and learned from a mistake that he made?
Yeah.
Then you've got to bring the kid back for detention on Saturday. I mean, yeah. That is so beautiful. That is wonderful. So, Amber, I'm just curious. What do you think about his application of restorative justice at St. Patrick's? What do you think of the example he shared?
I think that's awesome to be able to formulate not just that mindset, but those type of coping skills. Because no longer, if you're already groomed in, I'm here to build a community. It's not, you don't have to worry about unprogramming the mindset of self-preservation to the point to where it harms another individual. We will be working with St. Pat's this semester. We already created a curriculum. We have some tools. You know, we have some ways to identify some topics and some conflict and resolution. And so I'm excited.
Mm. Are you seeing this technique used? You've mentioned that you're using it within the penal system. Mm-hmm. But are you seeing it used in other school districts, or in what other places are you seeing restorative justice, a practice that's being taken on?
Now, school districts, Florissant and Ferguson and Normandy school districts, have now adopted restorative justice methodology and practices. They have not removed detention, as we hope they will, but they are practicing restorative justice practices. Here in St. Louis, we have a department called the Public Safety Department. It's its own department to address those that have violations and conflicts within the classroom or individual disturbances. And so they have a whole governing body that circumvents between teacher to principal.
We're coming to the end of our time here, but I'd like to hear you talk a little bit more about the circles. And I don't know, Michael, if you've used the circles at St. Patrick's and you can address this. If our listeners were to walk into a classroom where there was a restorative justice circle, what would they see happening? And I'm not sure who's the best to answer that.
I can talk about what we do. One thing that we do at the end of the school day, first through fifth, they leave their classrooms and another staff member and I, the student culture coordinator, Ted McCrary, and I will have each class sit down on the gym floor in groups of four. And they really just, it's as simple as sharing what happened that day with each other in the circle. And we have a list of prompts for them. Think, you know, asking them questions like, what was something you did today that made God smile? And it is a real challenge for anyone of most ages to wait until someone is done talking before they start talking and to actually listen to someone instead of waiting for your turn to talk. It, you know, all of us, it happens all the time. I'm sure everyone listening can think of plenty of people who do this to them. And if we, you know, think hard enough, we do it ourselves to other people. And so the first challenge is always to get kids to listen to whoever has the talking ball. It's a rubber ball. I have dozens more in storage in my office when they, you know, wear them out. And I mean, that honestly is part of it, because they'll wear them out when they'll get nervous or look for, you know, and start picking at them, or it can be, and if not just give someone an opportunity for introspection, it ensures that they're going to have three classmates who are going to listen to whatever they say, and it's going to be respected. It's a guarantee that you will be respected whatever you say, and something that's basically very vulnerable. And so they pass around the ball, and the whole thing takes about 15 minutes. And it's really helpful for me to see not just who's really struggling to wait their turn and who's struggling to respect others, but also what they're sharing can be really insightful, because, of course, when you give a child a chance to share something vulnerable, you know, things come up that you wouldn't have ever heard before. You know, something that happened, you know, at breakfast that morning, something that happened in the classroom, and they really never would have had a chance to share that. And it's never something that would have been a safety concern, but it's something clearly that affected them, that's still on their mind. If it's still on their mind at 3:11, then it's happened several times that I've had a chance at that point, the school day ends at 3:30, to still do some more sharing and work with them after that with the 15 minutes left in class, and sometimes with another student and who might have said something that hurt them. And it's also something, there are so many opportunities to praise them with the proactive circles at the end of the day. And there are so many times when a student who really struggles, and frankly, probably always will struggle to keep up with other kids in the classroom, to have an opportunity to tell them, wow, you were such a good listener today. I really respect that. Thank you so much. And it makes their day, because it's schoolwork can be hard for people to win praise the same way an athletic team, you know, for some kids, it can be hard to win praise on the basketball team if you're just not a great athlete. But everyone can earn praise in a circle. But, you know, communities do have conditional rules. To earn that praise, you're going to need to respect others. You'll need to be safe. And it is really what I see as religion in practice. It's real Christianity. Listening to each other and being truly present is the end goal. Real presence is what the education needs to lead to. If not, it's really a waste of our time to have a religion class if we're not actually going to practice this in the school. So the proactive listening circles at the end of every school day are something we're definitely keeping.
Fantastic.
I would like, I know, sister, that you're running out of time. I just would like to speak to to the question, and just leave your audience with the understanding that there's variations of circles. Mr. Carlson spoke to the proactive circles, which are awesome in the educational systems, and because it initiates the conversation, dialogue, and the language, and it also gives each one an opportunity to learn different skills, attentive listening skills, the opportunity to allow them to feel validated. But I do want it to be understood that the circle is in a circle for a reason, that it removes all hierarchy and it creates an environment of equity for every individual. That's why it's in a circle. Everyone's able to see each other on their own level. And so there's the structure of a circle, which involves, as he spoke of the ball, which is a talking piece. The person that has the ball is the one that is speaking. There's a facilitator, and then we have a way to decompress. So as you go through those emotions and you're able to await how you're going to verbalize, one, you're thinking how you want to deliver, how you want to be heard. Two, you're able to be heard. And three, it also creates empathy as you listen to the next individual explain how they're feeling. And so all those components are relevant in every circle at every age. And so the idea that there is a proactive circle, there is a responsive circle, there is a transformative circle, there is a healing circle, We just had a community health fair, a back to school, school drive, where five different faith-based organizations were represented, and we had a healing circle, and we came together to pray over our community.
Thank you for that. That's clarifying. And the circles are not just an opportunity to share feelings, but an opportunity to grow as individuals, as a community, and to become transformed. And that can, just like when you drop a pebble in the lake, right? That's going to have an impact well beyond the school community itself and throughout the entirety of a community in which restorative justice practices are engaged. So I thank you both very much for your help.
Sure. I welcome any questions that anyone may have. Sister has my personal information, and I'll forward the website information. Any questions that you may have, any inquiries, there's no question that is not to be answered. I make myself available, and I don't personally have the answer, we will seek out the answer. And so thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity. Especially because it's the Dominican Sisters of Springfield podcast. They have been leading and teaching at St. Pat's since 1910, and we're still very lucky to have Sister Angeline teaching phonics and Sister Marilyn Jean on our board. So I think this is a natural continuation of our partnership with St. Pat's, and I look forward to continuing it.
Thanks so much to Amber Harris and Michael Carlson for sharing their experience with restorative justice and helping us imagine ways we can implement the practices of restorative justice in our own lives and workplaces. A note to our listeners, the websites and resources we mention in this podcast are available in the show notes at flowcastlisten.org. Thank you for listening, and please join us next time.